You do your very best now, Forrest.
I sure will, Mama.
I remember the bus ride on the first day of school very well.
Are you coming along?
Mama said not to be taking rides from strangers.
This is the bus to school.
I'm Forrest Gump.
I'm Dorothy Harris.
Well, now we ain't strangers anymore. The slate's taken.
You know, it's funny what a young man recollects.
You can sit here if you want. Well, you're gonna sit down, aren't you?
What's wrong with your legs?
I'm nothing at all, thank you. My legs are just fine and dandy.
I just sat next to her on that bus and had a conversation all the way to school.
My back's crooked like a question mark. These are gonna make me
next to Mama,
narrow.
No one ever talked to me or asked me questions.
Are you stupid or something?
Mama says stupid is as stupid does.
I'm Jenny.
I'm Forrest Gump.
From that day on, we was always together. Jenny and me was like peas and carrots.
Oh, Forrest Gump never gets old. Do you remember your first day of school? Do you remember what it was like? Was it scary? Was it intimidating? Was it fun? This past week, I saw the school bus pull up to pick up the boy who lives across the street from us. And I remember just a few years ago, his first day of school. I was getting in the car, raised the garage door, getting ready to go to work. I could see his dad out in the driveway with him, patting him on the back, leaning over. I figured he was whispering words of assurance. It was going to be okay. He'd be fine. And then the bus pulled up, and the boy turned around and bolted for the house. It was one of these painful scenes because the dad goes chasing after him, pleading for the boy to come back, and then kind of reverts to the more forceful, "Now you get back here right now," while the bus is sitting there waiting. And I could hear the boy scream, "No, I don't want to go. Why do I have to go?" You ever said something like that? "No, I don't want this change in my life. I don't want to go to school. I don't want to go to college. I'm not ready for my child to go to college. I'm not ready for this job change. I don't want this divorce. I don't want to be alone. I don't want to grow old. I don't want to leave my house. I don't want to give up my car keys." Life is a series of changes and transitions. But the two are not the same thing. In his best-selling book, Managing Transitions, William Bridges makes the distinction between change and transition. Change, he says, is situational. It's the situations we find ourselves in life. It's the things that just happen to us. It's the changes we go through. Transition, however, he points out, is psychological. It's the attitudes and approach we bring to change. Transition is how we choose to face the changes in our lives. So, starting today, as you've heard for a few weeks, we're going to talk about transitions. This is a time of year when actually a lot of transitions happen for many people. Of course, schools change. People are going back to school. Many people change jobs this time of year. People are moving, going into new homes and new neighborhoods, and the rest of us are going through whatever the changes of life bring us. And we're going to think about what are the resources of our faith that help us develop transition approaches to the changes of life. We're going to look at different transitions we face, and we start today with what is perhaps the hardest transition: forced transitions. The changes that happen to us, we have no choice in. They occur, and we have to face them. What do you do when you're faced with a forced transition? Well, let's start with our biblical reflections each week with a very well-known moment in Old Testament history. The children of Israel camped along the edge of the Red Sea. They had been slaves in Egypt for 400 years, which is as long a period of time as the first slave ships from Africa landed on the coast of Virginia in this country 400 years ago. During this entire time, these centuries, the people have cried out to God, "Send us a liberator, set us free, change us." They wanted a change until they got one. God answered their prayer and sent Moses, their deliverer, who went straight to Pharaoh right off the bat and said, "Set my people free." It had about as much impact as a United Nations resolution against Russia. So, God sent 10 plagues that made life harder and more miserable for the Israelites. But it also crippled the nation. And Pharaoh, after the 10th plague, was forced to relent and allow the Israelites to go into the wilderness for a 3-day journey and conduct a religious festival, which everybody knew what that means. They're gone. They have left the country for good. Now, imagine if Egypt had been a democracy back in that day, and it was an election year. Pharaoh has just released over 1 million slaves. The Egyptian economy is about to tumble. And he has long forgotten in this short period of time what led him to this point, what God had done with these 10 plagues. Instead, he's now thinking politically. When you think politically, you tend not to think spiritually. And so he sends the army after the Israelites. They chase them to the edge of the Red Sea, and they realize they are now trapped. And now it's the Israelites' turn to think politically. They realize they're hemmed in, they've got no place to go, they're about to be slaughtered or they're going to be drowned. And so what do? They cry out to the one who got them in that predicament in the first place. It's an election season in Israel, and they look to Moses and say, "We need to vote the bum out of office. Why did this guy do this to us?" And what no one in the whole equation is thinking about is what God has already done or what God can do. And yet, with this scene of the Israelites hemmed in along the edge of the Red Sea, we actually have a picture of the first step of transition. The first thing we should do when we're facing a transition, particularly a forced transition, is to accept that we have come to an end. The first step in facing a transition is to accept when something in life has ended. Again, going back to William Bridges in his book, he writes, "Before you can begin something new, you have to end what used to be before you can learn a new way of doing things. You have to unlearn the old way." That will be a problem again and again and again for the Israelites. They are going to have a hard time unlearning the old ways of slavery because they haven't let it end. And when we come to a place that is an end and we know that it has ended and there really is no choice to go back, we have to do whatever we have to do to come to terms with that and to accept it. And that's not a quick thing. Sometimes we need a period of time to grieve over what has ended. As bad as Egypt was, there were things about it the Israelites will miss. They will miss the predictability of life. They will miss knowing that they will have food to eat and water to drink. As bad as all of the other things were, they will come to a time when they yearn for that again. Sometimes when we go through an ending, we need people we can speak out our emotions to. People who will listen to us, who won't tell us, oh, you need to forget that now, it's time to move on. Somebody who will let us talk about the grief that we feel and how hard this change is. We all need that. Sometimes we need rituals. We need rituals where we recognize that something has ended, because we're going to have to learn a new way. And unless we end what has been in our lives and claim that, it'll be hard to move forward. Over and over again, the Israelites will look back and say, oh, we want to go back to that place, which they can't go back to because they never released it. Look at what they said to Moses. What have you done to us, bringing us out of Egypt? Is this not the very thing we told you in Egypt? Let us alone so that we can serve the Egyptians. Why didn't Moses challenge them on that? I don't know. He should have said, you never told me that. None of you ever said that to me back in Egypt. You prayed for 400 years. Get us out of here. You didn't say leave us alone. What's happened to them? Even though they can't go back, they want to pretend they can because they haven't released it. You know, when our present location does not show us how we're going to get to a better place, we will yearn for old places even though they weren't good places. I know, Lord, my home wasn't that great, but I can't stand being homeless. Just let me go home again. Lord, I know that that relationship was no good. I know that that person I was with, that man, that woman, they were no good for me. But Lord, I hate being alone. I'm going to sit at home and pray every day until you open that door and they walk through again. I know, Lord, that job I had was causing me stress. It was wearing me out. It was taking a toll on me. But Lord, I don't like being without a job. Just give me my old job back. If it's up to us, many times we will never get to a better place, because we don't want to face the journey that getting there will require. If it's up to us, we'll stay right where we are because it feels less painful, and we'll hold on to the old. In order to get us to a better place, sometimes the situation just has to be forced, where we don't have a choice but to go forward. Dave Bolander is a member of our church who has been serving as an intern this summer. He's going to Christian Theological Seminary here in Indianapolis, and he's starting the process to be ordained in the United Methodist Church. In fact, his aim is to be a Christian counselor, maybe have his own counseling practice one day. But he's been interning this summer in our worship department, helping us, and he's sitting up behind all the texts this morning, Dave. And when we were talking about this sermon, He pointed out to me a scene in a movie I had long forgotten. It stars George Clooney, called Up in the Air. And in this movie, Clooney plays a corporate downsizing expert. You know what that means? A company that's getting rid of a significant part of its workforce pays for somebody to come in and do the dirty work for the executives and to tell people you're out of a job. Now imagine how people react to that. Somebody's paid to come and sit down and tell them you're not going to be paid anymore. People react violently. But in one scene, George Clooney is telling a man who's having a hard time taking on this information, and he tries to help him see the opportunity in it. Take a look at this.
So although I wish I were here with better news, the fact is that you and I are sitting here today because this will be your last week of employment at this company.
What do you suggest I tell them?
Bob, I'm a wake-up call. You know why kids love athletes?
Oh.
Kids love athletes because they follow their dreams. How much did they first pay you to give up on your dreams?
$27,000 a year.
And when were you going to stop and come back and do what makes you happy? I see guys who work at the same company for their entire lives, guys exactly like you. They clock in, they clock out, and they never have a moment of happiness. You have an opportunity here, Bob. This is a rebirth. Now, if not for you, do it for your children.
You know, sometimes, if it's left up to us, we won't get to a better place. The situation has to be forced. In order to get to our dreams, something has to be forced. In order to get to a better place, something has to be forced. And when we're in a forced change, that's when our faith can make the greatest difference for us. In recognizing that God can take any ending and lead us to a new beginning. God can take any end we face and get us to a better place. In fact, to make sure you hold on to that, say that with me. God can take any end I face. No, repeat after me, not the screen. Try, I didn't give you that little bit. God can take any end I face and get me to a better place. Now, sometimes we're not at the better place to say it. We have to hold on to it when we're in the unwanted place, the place where things have been forced upon us, the changes we don't want, and hold on and say, no, I believe, even right here at the edge of the Red Sea with the waves crashing and the clouds of the chariots behind me, I'm going to believe God can get me to a better place. The next time you're facing an unwanted transition in your life, just read Psalm 77. Listen to the way this psalm begins. In the day of my trouble, I seek the Lord. In the night, my hand is stretched out without wearying. My soul refuses to be comforted. I think of God and I moan. I meditate and my spirit faints. Chances are, the writer of this psalm was going through some kind of unwanted change. And the writer is getting out his frustration with God. It continues, I consider the days of old and remember the years of long ago. What is he saying? God, just get me back where I used to be. Things were so much better then. And it continues on. Will the Lord spurn forever? Has his steadfast love ceased forever? Has God forgotten to be gracious? Has he in anger shut up his compassion? What is the writer saying? God, why are you giving me the middle finger? I know that's crass, but come on. Have you ever felt that way? Honestly? God, why are you giving me the middle finger? Why are you doing this to me? Why have you allowed my life to get in this situation and to not change it the way I'd like to see it change? Why did you take away the good things I had in my life? But go back and look at the end of that verse again. Has he in anger shut up his compassion? Selah. Remember when we talked about Psalms last month? We talked about that word Selah one day. It's like a rest symbol in music. It means to pause. The writer's getting out his frustrations with God, and then the writer pauses and decides to practice what is called salvation history. Salvation history is remembering what we know God has done in the past. It's going back to the very beginning and recalling everything God has done. It's sort of like saying, I'm going to hold on to what I know that I know down in my soul. I can't prove it. I can't convince you, but me, I know it. I know the things God has done for me. So the writer practices salvation history and begins to recall everything God has done. And by the end of the psalm, the writer remembers this scene of the Israelites trapped at the edge of the Red Sea when Moses parted the sea. And the next to last verse of the psalm says, your way was through the sea, your path through the mighty waters, yet your footprints were unseen. And the writer is in a different place by the end of that psalm. I pause and I go back and I remember and I hold on to what God has done before me, and I remember that God makes a way that seems impossible. Even though God's footprints can't be seen, you just know that it's God doing it. But that's between the ending and the new beginning. And the place in between those two is a neutral zone. In fact, that's what William Bridges says are the three places of transition: ending, neutral zone, and beginning. And the hardest sometimes is to be in the neutral zone. You can accept that something has ended, but you have yet to see and experience something beginning. What do you do when you're in that neutral zone? You can believe that God can take this situation and give you a new start, but you don't see it yet. What do? You stand firm and see. You stand firm and see. That's what Moses told the Israelites to do at the edge of the Red Sea. Listen again to what he said. Do not be afraid. Stand firm and see the deliverance that the Lord will accomplish for you today. The Lord will fight for you, and you have only to be still. Moses is giving them a word of hope. God is going to work deliverance for you, but you must be still. Now, that's not passive do nothing. There's activity in that being still. The important words are the earlier ones spoken. Stand firm and see the deliverance. Stand courageous and be on the lookout for what God is doing. Because if you allow yourself to get so focused on where you're not and what used to be and where you wish you were back to, you'll miss what God shows you. You'll miss what God wants you to hear. Stand firm and look for what God's doing. 75-year-old man in our church came to see me in my office a few weeks ago. He found out that he has cancer, and now there's a lot of uncertainty about the future. He's facing a significant forced transition in his life, and he doesn't know what it's going to mean. There's been a lot of apprehension and uncertainty. But he told me a story that he said allowed his whole approach to this thing to just flip. It happened at the oncology center. He went for an appointment, and as he was standing in the lobby with other patients waiting to go into the waiting room, he got to know a young man standing close to him, and he only learned a couple of facts about him. He's from Texas, he's 32 years old, and he was there with his parents. They go into the waiting room, he got called first, he goes in for treatment, he comes back out and sits down as he's waiting then for a nurse to come and talk with him before he leaves. He's lost in his own thoughts about what is going on, what this is going to mean in his life, what it could mean, what he doesn't know it's going to mean. But then he thought, wait a minute, there are a lot of other people in here right now. And he just started looking around, paying attention to the room. And as he's looking and listening, he hears the young man he met earlier say, "I'm so glad I had that stroke." He was talking to a nurse. And he just was completely perplexed by this. Who would be thankful for a stroke? He was perplexed because of how young the man is, that he should have a stroke, but then that he would be thankful for it. He went over and sat next to him, and he goes, I heard you say this. I have to ask you, why are you thankful for it? The man said, well, because of that stroke, I found out I have brain cancer. So now I'm doing something about it and I'm getting the treatment I need. He just sat back in his chair and he said, it's like instantly everything flipped for him. He realized, I'm 43 years older than this man. I can say I've already lived a good life. I'm lucky. And if this man can say I'm thankful, I can too. And I can choose to believe that God is in this situation with me. And who knows what God is going to do through it and because of it. He said it all just kind of flipped. That's what our faith is meant to do for us. That when we just stand still and listen and look out, We hear what God wants us to hear. We see something that flips it for us and makes us realize we have one who is with us, because that's what our salvation history shows us. We have one, the Son of God named Jesus Christ, who is with us, who faced the worst ending ever. He was crucified, died, buried in a tomb. It was the end. And God brought him back from the grave. Death could not hold him. And he is alive to come and stand with us, to bring us through all of our changes, so that one day we can be transitioned with him to an even better place. Last Sunday night, Dr. David Wilkinson, who was with us last Sunday morning, who led us in a lunch, then did a hour and a half question and answer time in the Great Hall. About 120 of you came. And somebody asked him, and all of his knowledge of the universe and spirituality and life itself, does he believe there's a heaven? And what is it like? Dr. Wilkinson started talking about John Wesley's thoughts about heaven, and also C.S. Lewis. And in C.S. Lewis's book, The Shadowlands, he said, if you remember that book, C.S. Lewis talks about the gray world where things are not clear. He wasn't talking about the next world. He was talking about this world. He said, we live in the shadowlands. We don't see things clearly. But when we get to heaven, we will discover a light that is more vivid, more real, more beautiful than what this world had to hold. We can look forward to that we have a Savior who is always bringing us to a good place. Sometimes it begins with accepting when something comes to an end. And it always means believing that no matter the ending, God can give us a new beginning. And in the meantime, to stand firm and see. Amen.